Hi, my name is Sam Blezard. Welcome to Comms from the Shed, the interview show where you get to hear from a range of diverse and interesting voices on how they've coped during the global pandemic. In this series, we'll be taking an informal look at life, talking to people who've been doing incredible things, and asking them about their hopes for the future in both their personal and professional lives. Hope you enjoy it. Today we welcome Catherine Delapour. Catherine is putting emotional intelligence at the heart of leadership development. She's a leadership coach with a 20 plus year career in the commercial sector, and we are delighted to welcome her into the shed today. Catherine, welcome.
Really pleased to be here, Sam. Thanks for having me.
We are talking today about emotional intelligence, about leadership development, self-awareness, all very important topics. And I mean, for our listeners, if you were to Google the definition of emotional intelligence, the following comes up. And I'll just read this definition out just before we get into this. Emotional intelligence is the capacity to be aware of, control, and express one's emotions, and to handle interpersonal relationships judiciously and empathetically. Emotional intelligence is the key to both personal and professional success. I mean, that's quite a big claim, isn't it? What's your initial reaction to revisiting that definition?
Yeah, it's a good definition. I mean, I always think of emotional intelligence kind of in three ways. I think about the self-management piece, which probably is the most important. So the ability to understand one's thoughts and emotions. And depending on which generation you sit in, I think this whole exploration of emotions is, for some of us oldies, quite challenging. But the truth is, and I'm an anthropologist, so that's what I studied at university many years ago. And, you know, we are sentient beings. That's what humans are. We are driven, we are motivated through emotions. In fact, the word emotion originates from, I think it's a Latin word, motere, which means to move. And we can move towards things or we can move away from things. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges in relation to work. I think in the 20th century, emotions, we were almost asked to leave our emotions at the door. In fact, that's a familiar terminology to me, leave your emotions at the door. There is no place for emotions here, which is interesting. So self-management is really important. Relationship management is key. That connectivity between humans is incredibly important. I mean, at the end of the day, we've spent most of our time evolving and developing in groups. We're not solo players. We're not. We operate best within a community setting. Why is that? Very simply, because that's the best place to stay safe and survive. So that relationship management piece is very important. And of course, our brains have developed into social brains. And that's how we're so good and why we're so good at adapting and evolving, because we've developed culture. So that's the second piece. And then the third piece is managing change management. And we are, again, highly adept at being agile and changing depending on the environment that we're in. You know, behavior, all human behavior is contextual. We adapt, we're good at it. But it's almost as if in the 20th century, somewhere along the lines, we forgot in a business setting that we are very, very good at it. And we became frightened and fearful of change. And I think the 21st century offers us an opportunity to reconnect with that ability.
There's so much of what you're saying there is fascinating. I almost don't know which piece to go after first. So it's a nice challenge to have. You mentioned actually stripping kind of human beings almost back to their basics and the emotions that we feel. you know, to start at the ground level, to anyone who struggles with this concept of controlling their emotions, you know, I'm thinking about anyone who may be in a management position or a leadership position. If anyone does struggle to control their emotions or negative thoughts or feelings, what would your advice be? I mean, what lessons have you learned along the way in your capacity as a coach?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think the first thing is to recognize that we have emotions. So I think some people sit there, and in fact, I remember doing some coaching with a big media company and speaking to one of the delegates, and he said to me, "I don't have emotions," which was an interesting idea. So let's just say, to start with, we have emotions. All human beings have emotions. Whether or not we are in touch with our emotions is a separate thing. What is really, really fascinating for me, and really it's a framework that was developed, you know, about 50 years ago, cognitive behavioral therapy, which helps us to understand the brain and how humans have an operating system, essentially. And it's a very simple but fundamental reality of being human, which is the way we think. So that's our thoughts, our values, our beliefs impact our emotions, how we feel, impact the way we behave. That's how it works. Thought, emotion, action. So I think the first thing that I will encourage my clients to do in a coaching setting is to just spend time with yourself and get in touch with your emotions and become emotionally literate. And what I mean by that is, I think the English language actually is quite restrictive in many ways in terms of words that describes our feelings. I mean, there are other languages. I think Italian is a good example. And I was never a linguist, but I'm interested in the power of words. And of course, you will be as well, Sam, because you're a comms expert. The power of language is so important. And even if you just take the word love, in English, that's it. We have one word for love. In other languages, in Italian, we're showing hearts here, everyone. You know, there's lots of different types of love. Of course there are. You know, there's love between a mother and a father. There's love, it's a romantic love. There's, all the different types of love you can imagine. Friendship, the love between colleagues, it's vast. And yet we restrict ourselves to one word. And that's the problem in many ways, is our language doesn't allow us to express ourselves in the way that I think some people, you know, want to be able to express themselves. We're restricted in that respect.
No, I think that's absolutely fascinating what you say about language. And again, I don't mean this to sound too trite, but I was really interested to hear what you say there about how people may think about themselves and struggling to control any negative emotions, because, you know, that's obviously what self-awareness can often be as a leader, or an aspect of it. But is it too trite to say that actually working on the basis of just being more positive on a daily basis is a good place to start? I mean, what are the sort of practical measures that people can take? You know, if you're a leader of people or if you're a manager of people, you know, what are the things, actually basic principles, that people need to look at in themselves?
That's a great question. I mean, look, one of the things that I've learned through getting to understand what emotional intelligence is actually certain traits within emotional intelligence that you can measure are actually attributable to human happiness, to being content. So let's think about that idea of being happy and contented and juxtapose that with a person who is having negative thoughts about themselves. And there are four elements. And interestingly enough, to your point, positive mental attitude, or what is described within the EQ model that I use a lot, is optimism. To have a, and really, look, what is optimism? It is about hope. That's what it boils down. I have a hopeful vision for my future. And I am, and actually, I am future oriented. I'm not stuck in the past. And what you realize when you start coaching people is that feeling of being stuck is often linked with thoughts or beliefs I have had about myself, which may in fact be outdated, but they've never been challenged. No one has ever gone in and had that conversation where the coachee has the opportunity to expose those thoughts and emotions and really dig into them and challenge them. And the job of the coach is to build a deeply trusting relationship so that the person, the coachee, feels able and willing to disclose the stuff that's going on inside their head. We all have that internal narrative that whirs and whirs and whirs. And so many people who haven't had the opportunity to say this stuff out loud, it's when we say it out loud that we have the opportunity almost to step away from the thing being the belief, the thought. And then we can, from that point of view of objectivity, see the thing for what it really is. It's just a thing. And maybe that thing, in coaching terms, we call it a limiting belief or a limiting assumption. And the problem is that we go through life and stuff happens to us. And if we don't get given the opportunity to make sense of that experience, it stays with us and we become stuck in the past, literally.
That is really, that's really, really interesting. Now, I mentioned some quite basic principles, and you've given me some fantastic thoughts on some of those things, whether that's about controlling negative emotions, but also the need to be a more positive individual. You talked about the baggage of the past there. There's a phrase that many people will have heard, possibly within the corporate world or within wider society, and it's one that you've referenced yourself recently on social media. That phrase is psychological safety. Now, for anybody listening who hears me use those two words and thinks, well, what does that mean? I mean, what would your definition of psychological safety be, and why is it sort of relevant in terms of what we're discussing today?
Yeah, I mean, it's terminology that has really come into the modern kind of workplace vernacular. And it's based on the work of Professor Amy Edmondson, who has written a fantastic book called The Fearless Organization, and some work that she did, you know, many, many years ago, I think with Google, with a client where she had the opportunity to kind of understand what was it that was enabling teams at Google to perform very, very well, and other teams were performing less well. So what was it? What was that thing that was making all the difference? And it boiled down to, drum roll, psychological safety. So to define psychological safety, it is the ability for people to take interpersonal risks in a working environment. So what is an interpersonal risk? It is when you're sitting in a meeting, for example, and you want to put your hand up and ask a question because perhaps you haven't understood something. But something inside your head is going, you're going to look a bit stupid if you ask this question, or people will expect me to know that. So I don't want to take the risk of being ridiculed in that situation. Or maybe you are a more experienced manager. And again, there is an expectation there that you have a particular skill set, or that you know how to do something. I don't know, a performance review or something like that, something that you would just take for granted. Oh, if you're a manager, you should know how to do that. And in fact, you're being rewarded for the fact that you supposedly know this thing. But guess what? Nobody ever taught it to you. And again, are you prepared to step forward and say, I don't know this stuff? Can someone train me in it? Can someone teach me? Can I watch somebody doing this? People won't step forward for fear of retribution, for fear of being embarrassed, for fear of even losing their job or being demoted. I mean, this is what is really going on. So that interpersonal risk-taking is, can the manager, and it, to me, it really, you know, the managers are like frontline workers. They are responsible for creating a climate within a team where it is safe to take risks, where it is safe for people to speak up, where it is safe for direct reports to say to their manager, actually, I need to challenge you on this, or to be candid. Candor is actually one of the four C's of how to build a trusted relationship. If you don't have psychological safety, people won't speak up. There's a really interesting statistic I saw recently, something like 42% of people leave meetings having said nothing.
This thing about psychological safety is really, the trust is a big part of it, isn't it? And also it makes you think about, I mean, it certainly, when I was listening to you talk, it makes me think about, you know, my favorite sort of managers or sort of leaders over time. And I was very interested, and to anybody who is listening, there's some tremendous podcasts that Catherine is involved in, sometimes as host, sometimes as participant. There's some great conversations, so I would encourage everyone to listen. But I listened to one, and I think at one stage you were reflecting on a favorite leader or a favorite manager. And just before you go on to talk about this person, I'm going to refer to somebody early in your career. You were actually very candid yourself, and I was interested to hear you say that at 22 years old, you were thrust into a management position because you were performing well, I think in sales, if I'm right.
Yes.
But I was really tickled to hear you say that at the time, if you had a bit of honest reflection, you said you didn't really like people. And in fact, you may not have even been ready to manage anyone. Could you just give us a little sort of flavor of that early part in your career? And actually the manager, I think the chap's name was Martin Leach, that you referenced, yes. Because it's quite interesting, I think, given where your career has gone and how it's evolved, that early seminal experience.
Mm. Well, look, he was he's been a huge influence on my life and my career. Incredibly charismatic man, an exceptional sales leader, just a natural people person, you know, a real connector, and very, very creative. Kind of my alter ego, actually. I think that's why Martin and I got on so well, because he was all about people and ideas. I am much more of a systems thinker. I'm much more into the detail. I kind of geek out on facts and figures, and, you know, I'm more logically, I have a preference for logic and results. I mean, sales was kind of, I was made for sales. Sales was made for me because I like having a target and going after it. Certainly in my early career, that really suited me. But no one asked me, do you want to be a manager? The opportunity was, can I make more money? Oh, yes, you can if you become a manager. I'm like, sign me up. but nobody actually sat down. I mean, look, this is not untypical. I think what a lot of people forget is the majority of people in this country, in the United Kingdom, are employed in small and medium-sized businesses. And so there isn't funds, there isn't infrastructure. You kind of learn on the job. And I think I was at least a year, if not 18 months, into just being a sales exec before we got any sales training. That's not to say we weren't learning on the job, because we had these funny phones where Martin could just literally come and pick up these headpieces and listen into calls. Honestly, if someone had videoed that now, I would just love to see it, because it was brilliant. It was theater, Sam, because people would be on a call and Martin was a really intuitive salesperson, and he loved to use silence, and he loved this idea of how you can use your voice as an instrument to persuade, to influence. I mean, the first 3 years of my job selling was all telephone based. We didn't get out and meet clients. It was all, can you connect with somebody in 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds? And it was all voice.
You've reminded me, actually. Sorry, Catherine, I was going to say, you reminded me that earlier in my career, I worked in telesales for Royal Mail briefly. So I had that thing where I was connected to people. It is a really interesting experience, especially when there's a high volume of calls, but you know, how you evolve that approach. Listening to you talk as well, I'm thinking kind of about leadership more broadly and in different ways. And if we look at the global sort of level, and just to be a little bit topical, if you don't mind, yeah. I mean, this week I also saw that you shared a clip on Twitter about sustainability, and it was talking about, you know, global warming and the threat that we all face. But actually, there's a really interesting thing that we might talk about here, which is the self-awareness of leaders at COP26, because a lot has been made, rightly so, in the media of leaders turning up in 26 car motorcades, gas guzzling planes, trains and automobiles, maybe not so much trains, but you know, I just kind of wondered what could leaders at COP26 be doing to be slightly more self-aware, do you think?
That's a really great question. Yeah, look, leaders, ideally, we look to leaders to show us an example, to be role models for certain behaviors. And, you know, just based on the description that you've just given, I mean, that's not really happening. But I suppose you've got to balance that with, I mean, I was speaking to my husband last night about, imagine trying to organize that event from a security perspective. What, I mean, literally, that, can you imagine the hell that would be? So I take my hat off to the people who've organized it, and you've got all these world leaders gathering. So I don't know. I'm sure there is some way that you could pair things back. But I mean, people have got to get there, and they've got to get there quickly and efficiently. And there was something on the radio this morning about, you know, the cost of rail travel compared to the cost of, you know, flying. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? We don't have good public transport infrastructure that is cost effective. We just don't in this country.
No, absolutely. And, you know, it makes me also sort of think, because I was actually chatting to my team briefly earlier, because I mentioned that we were going to be talking, and I said, you know, we're going to be talking about sort of leadership, and Katie said to me, well, what do you mean by leadership? I thought, oh yeah, very good. And of course, can we all be leaders in this space? So I put it to you, Catherine, is it possible? Is this really a thing for leaders, or is the emotional intelligence and self-awareness sort of piece, is it about everybody actually aspiring to this and inspiring each other as well?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about emotional intelligence, it's something that, you know, we can get better at. It's something, it's almost like the wisdom of age. You know, you learn stuff as you go along, you become more worldly wise, you understand how the world works, you can be, as I said, kind of more objective about stuff that happens to you. You don't have to, you know, catastrophize things. I mean, that was probably, you know, we all have unhelpful thoughts, you know, whether we like it or not. That's just a reality of life. But I think as we get older and wiser, we're able to sort of see it for what it is. Oh, that thing happened. Oh, well, move on. Whereas when you're younger, it's, you know, you're so much more driven emotionally. I remember way back when I was like 14 or 15, and I went to this German language camp, and I was there primarily to learn German because my German teacher told my parents I was going to fail my O level. And so my parents paid an inordinate amount of money for me to go to the Black Forest and learn German. Unfortunately, there were a whole load of other people there who wanted to learn English. And who was I to stop that happening? So we just hung out with some amazing kind of people, young people from Germany and Italy and what have you. Anyway, being the age that I was, I fell head over heels in love with not one, but two people over the 2 weeks. And the first young man was an Italian. And let me tell you, I remember coming back to my house and just being absolutely beside myself and begging my dad that I must go to Italy, like right now, and sobbing at the bottom of our garden because I couldn't see this young man. And it was ridiculous. Like a week later, I got over it because everything is felt. And I have teenagers now who are 16, and you know, it's very, I mean, I bought them these books on the teenage brain, which I must read myself, but the teenage brain is very, very different from an adult brain. Even like the smallest amount of excitement for a teenage brain apparently lights up so much more of the brain than it does in an adult brain. So just in terms of how the brain works and how it's wired and the neurochemicals that are fired up inside a teen brain is completely different to my old brain at 51. You know, I don't feel stuff as much, or maybe I'm just able to make sense of it because I have that perspective. I think that's the thing. It's about having a perspective because you've experienced more of life. And I think back to your question about leadership, I think absolutely everyone can be a leader. That doesn't necessarily mean leading a big multinational company, but it's, you know, everyone has the opportunity to sit in the driving seat of their own life and not letting life take you for a ride, but you taking life for a ride. And that's about sort of being prepared to say no to stuff and yes to other stuff rather than life just happening to you. Being a bit more intentional about the decisions that we make, understanding the importance of building really good networks, for example.
I'm just going to let my cat in because my cat, Tiddles, or Mr. Tiddles, is scratching at the door of the shed. So sorry, sorry about this. Come on, Tiddles, in you come. And of course,
you know, we've got a problem with the cat, Sam, because I'm actually allergic to cats.
Tiddles, hang on. Keep a safe distance from Catherine, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be respectful. He's giving me a funny look as if respectful isn't in his makeup. That's the great thing about cats. They have a very different take on emotional intelligence. One, they definitely have emotions. And two, I think they're way more intelligent than we are. Let's see, he wants back out instantly. So maybe he's concerned for your physical safety, in actual fact.
Well, that's true. That's true. But actually, animals, gosh, they are, you know, there's so much interesting stuff going on in the therapeutic world when it comes to animals. You know, they're bringing horses into hospitals now to meet with people who have terminal illness. They are, you know, there's dogs and that they bring in now to hospitals and hospices. Animals can be incredibly useful and helpful when it comes to helping humans to heal.
I was going to ask you about workplace choirs and the sense of community and some of the intangible benefits that they can bring. And I think the way you described it when I was listening to one of your podcasts was there's a sense of spirit, a sense of hope, and a sense of optimism that's generated. Can you just give us a little bit more about sort of workplace choirs, you know, why they've inspired you and, yeah, just the kind of the benefits that they bring?
I used to sing when I was at primary school. I was really quite into singing. I mean, I just think in general, the arts, so anything, you know, poetry, music, theatre, these are amazing spaces for humans to actually understand their emotions and make sense of experiences in a safe way. So I think that's the starting point. What's interesting about something like singing, and this is something that I learned recently, is actually singing requires like every aspect of your brain to be engaged. And so that, what does that mean? It means that you don't have any space or to kind of, you know, go off down some rabbit hole and think negative thoughts, because actually everything's focused on singing. And I think also singing is quite meditative as well. So I think the community element is incredibly important. Music is something that is incredibly personal. It can bring up so many different emotions. It can actually, I think, help to, I mean, if you think about concerts you've been to or, you know, music events or whatever, it's just so incredibly life-affirming. And I think I actually genuinely think that something like forming choirs at work could be the most brilliant way of making sense of the horrors of COVID and bringing people together, no matter where you are in an organization. I mean, people talk about, you know, we've got to break down these silos. Yeah. Why don't you just bring them into a choir? Or I heard something very interesting, actually slightly off topic, but where this organization sends random coffee email invites to people. So suddenly you're put together with, I don't know, somebody from finance, you're in marketing, you go and have a coffee, you know, let's break down the silos. If you want to do things, you can do it. It's all about, going back to that word, intention. I think the biggest mistake that organizations can make now is just to kind of whatever form of working they want, hybrid, in the office, out of the office, whatever they're going to do, is just to kind of go back to what we've always done before. I think that's the biggest mistake. And you know what? If they do that, unfortunately, they are going to lose their talent.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I think as well, picking up on something that you said earlier, and again, I've listened to a few things on my headphones in recent days, again, when I knew I was going to be talking with you. This point about if you don't love yourself and trust yourself first, you can't actually inspire others, make others feel good, work well with others. You know, at this point about motivation, money, and status, you know, because I was really interested to listen to a conversation you were in, which was really talking about what is your motivation to lead people? Because if your motivation is actually, and you did touch on this earlier, if it's about sort of promotion and if it's about status, then you're possibly not going to get the result that you want. And I just wondered if you had any additional sort of thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm nodding because that's so true. And that's why asking the question, why do you want to be a manager, is so, so important. And unfortunately, that conversation doesn't happen often enough. Or people are, in many ways, not really properly, I don't think, profiled for these roles. I mean, I'll give you a very simple example that's very close to home. I obviously got promoted very, very quickly. I think if I was in starting my career now, because companies have these individual contributor tracks, that's the track that I would have gone on. Certainly for the first 10 years of my career, I would imagine, maybe even up to the point when I had my children. I think that was the turning point for me in terms of, you know, literally moving from a place of being quite selfish, quite self-absorbed, it's just about me, really. On the other hand, I'm married to a man who is incredibly compassionate and, you know, builds trust very quickly and has deep empathy and all the stuff that I had to learn. And he never made it into a management role through his whole career. And I just think, and it beggars belief. And I see this all the time. There are people who would make brilliant managers who don't get promoted. And we promote the people, unfortunately, like me, who are winners at something that involves some kind of technical skill, like selling or marketing or comms or finance. You know, basically the results-oriented people.
I think that's a really interesting point. You know, the subject of this podcast is a sort of examination of emotional intelligence and self-awareness. And we've talked quite a bit in the last sort of half an hour about emotion. If I just touch on self-awareness for a second, because again, you know, when we say self-awareness, it can sound slightly glib, and it can sound like a very sort of modern sort of concern. But I've always been really interested in self-awareness from the point of view of, I think, doing the job that I do in communications, I've often described it as a privilege, because not only do we get to very occasionally sort of breathe the rarefied air of the leadership teams that we work with, we also get an incredible sort of bird's eye view of everything that's going on across the organization, you know, from a strategic point of view, all the activity, all the important things, basically, because you tend to communicate about all your priorities and the things that really matter to you. And so you're often engaged in those. And so that is a great privilege and a great responsibility. But I would say the leaders that I've observed, the ones that I really rated, who I felt connected with people, had just this incredible level of self-awareness, which was really acute. None of it was accidental. It was all, you used the word intentional, which is a good word. It was very intentional. It was very thoughtful. And I think the best way to describe it is that from the moment that they were visible, and I guess let's use physically visible in this context. So at the point at which they were driving up to their place of work, or walking in, or coming into reception, to the moment where the lights went out and they get in a car and they drive away over the horizon and they're no longer visible, they were completely switched on. And they displayed these fantastic qualities of, you know, charisma, positivity, very engaged, very interested, fantastic memory for the things that people were doing, names, faces, personal details, projects. And I think what's interesting about this, there's in my mind, there's been a really interesting documentary on about the Tony Blair, Gordon Brown years, if anyone has had the chance to watch it. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's a fascinating period in the UK's political life. And of course, the contrast in styles between Blair and Brown is fascinating in itself. And that dramatic tension and that period in history is fascinating. It's also of personal interest to me because I joined the Cabinet Office as part of their communications team, I think 2 weeks after what was called the managed transition between Blair and Brown had taken place. So I think Gordon Brown had just been in place as Prime Minister for 2 weeks, which in itself was fascinating to be sort of working in the inner sanctum of Whitehall. And of course, the other thing I would mention to you about this is a great example, and it was very unfortunate for Gordon Brown, but during one general election campaign, he was on the campaign trail and he was speaking to an elderly woman, I think of pensionable age, in a large crowd. And, you know, the cameras, as they always are, were right on top of them. He jumped into the back of a government car or a taxi. His mic was still on. And I think he mumbled something about, I think the phrase he used was bigoted woman. And he may have been feeling very frustrated at the time, or it was just that classic moment of just at the point at which you feel you can relax as a leader, or maybe some of your own inherent personal biases or frustrations bubble to the surface, but the mic is still on. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. And I just wondered if you had any favorite, just on that basis, that this piece about self-awareness, if you had any favorite leaders that you'd worked with over the years.
Very good question. I think, look, Martin, definitely my first boss, first proper boss, as it were, definitely had those qualities. And he was, look, he was a very, very good listener. That's a quality that I think that I look for in a leader, actually. And I may be biased because I'm an introvert. So that's a way that I like communicating. I listen intently. I often don't say anything. So I value that. I value that. For me, I think integrity has got to be one of the most important attributes of great leaders. Have I seen that necessarily on the ground in terms of my own direct bosses? To a certain extent, yes. Say what I mean what I say. I think that one of the things that for me makes a leader stand out is moral courage. And I think to get to a point where you're able to display moral courage, and for me that is, you think for yourself and you do the right thing, even if it means going against what everybody else is saying and doing. It almost requires an individual to go through a process that results in epiphany. And that may be therapy, or it may be a life-altering event. Maybe they were very, very ill, or they lost a loved one, or something happened where they suffered.
I think what you're basically saying, and some of the most important things about an individual having a high level of self-awareness, is it's partly about self-improvement. And you shared a great quote recently from, and I hope I pronounced the name right, from Marilla Giuliano, which was, "To stay alive and vibrant, you periodically need to refresh or reinvent yourself." And I really like that, because I think that's actually about what you're saying. It's having the courage to show vulnerability as a strength, which in itself is a very modern thought. But how close do you think we are getting to that, in either in society or sort of corporate life as a whole, you know, vulnerability being kind of treated as a strength?
The need is there. The way that humans interact, and particularly if there is a power differential, and there are, you know, in traditional organizations, in fact, probably even in more modern organizations, there are hierarchies. And what's really interesting about hierarchies is, where do we learn about hierarchies? We learn about hierarchies in our families. So, you know, mum and dad are in charge.
Well, I'm trying to be.
Exactly. I think our generation is really messed up, and we've somehow or other, the kids are in charge, but whatever. You know, one of the biggest coaching struggles, challenges that people have that I talk to is people find it very challenging to manage up. Why? Because of the family structures that they have come from. That, you know, you don't answer back to your parents, do you? And, you know, when you learn that and that's inculcated into your brain, guess what? You go into an environment where there is a slightly different, but effectively the same family structure, power differentials, you know, you're not going to speak up to the big daddy over there or the big mummy. You know, you just don't do that. And that's where we get stuck, or rather unstuck, as it were. I think there's a guiding principle, which I often refer to, which is this idea that you get the behaviors you reward. So let's apply that to this idea of vulnerability. Do you currently know, Sam, any organizations that are rewarding their managers for being vulnerable?
No.
And that is the answer to the question.
I think what you've just said there about the familial structure, and actually, you know, if you come from a family background of a strong parent or parents, your ability to manage upwards. I think that's absolutely fascinating. And I really hope that everyone listening kind of got something out of that, because it's a universal principle. And I think of the really strong characters, the big mummies and big daddies, as you called them, in the organizations I've worked with in the past. And actually that sense of fear that anybody would even consider challenging them, let alone actually speaking out in the open within a public forum or a meeting. I think that is absolutely fascinating. COVID-19 has obviously been this seismic moment of our age. I would argue it's probably been one of the most seismic events in terms of how it's impacted culture globally. We have, to some extent, had to just try and evolve on the hoof in this sort of virtual world. And I kind of wondered how you felt that has been for our ability to be more self-aware or emotionally intelligent. Has that helped in any way? Because I think a lot of people feel that that's actually hindered us being in a two-dimensional space rather than a three-dimensional space, actually has had quite a lot of negative impacts.
I think it depends on the individual, doesn't it? I was speaking to somebody this morning who took on a new, very senior sort of C-suite role. And she's been in post now for 3 months, and she's a very much an extroverted people person. And, you know, she wants to go back to the office. There's no doubt about it. She made that really clear. And she said it's particularly in the role that she's in. She needs to feel the culture. She needs to see it. She needs to mix with people. So I think, you know, for her particular needs, no, it's not really working for her, you know, but there are lots of other people where it has worked really well. So I think there are pros and cons. I do wonder if, I mean, look, there are headlines, right? You're a PR man, and this whole thing around the mass exodus, or whatever they call it, the mass resignation, or whatever, everyone's leaving their jobs or thinking about leaving their jobs. I think there was an opportunity when you're sort of sat at home, you maybe got a bit more time. I mean, did people have more time? I don't know. I think they were just working more overtime, weren't they? I mean, that's probably the truth. But let's imagine that maybe they had more opportunity to go for walks and sort of think and be a bit more introspective and question why they are doing what they are doing. So I think that's interesting, because unfortunately humans are creatures of habit, and we're not very intentional, and we just generally do the same stuff again and again and again, because it's easier to do that. It's not too taxing on the brain. But actually, when we're put into, it's a bit like when sometimes in order to get another idea, you need to move into a different space. You know how some people describe that they have their best ideas, I don't know, walking or in the shower or whatever. I think it's the same with any sort of idea generation, any kind of creative pursuit, and really imagining, unlocking your imagination so that you can dream. You can dream about what you want to do, you know, and think about what is your mission? What is the purpose of my life? Is my life meaningful? These are the questions that I think perhaps the pandemic was able to unlock some people's minds to the possibility that they didn't have to be an automaton anymore, that actually they could dream and they could dream big. I mean, purely from a financial perspective, because of course, you know, most of us are hamstrung by whatever, very large mortgages or rents. So therefore we kind of get trapped, if you like, inside a particular career trap and we can't get out. We don't have that choice. We don't have that freedom. But maybe because people were at home and they had been furloughed, maybe because they weren't going out and spending money on coffees and lunches, they were able to build a little nest egg, right? And maybe from that nest egg, and I know people, I don't know if you know people, Sam, but I know people who were, you know, suddenly became complete sales gurus on eBay and Amazon, and you know, they set up little businesses on the side, and suddenly you've got, you know, great entrepreneurship happening all over the place. And I've suddenly got a savings plan that I never had before, because I used to spend my money going out every night and extravagant meals and, you know, spending loads of money on clothes and drinks and stuff, and I'm not doing that anymore. So suddenly there is a possibility of a different future. And I think that's really exciting. I love that.
No, I do too. And actually, I set up some podcasts on the side. That was my thing, which was great fun. I'm still having fun with it. I mean, you know, God forbid that we might actually have some fun in our lives. But
yeah,
it tickled me. A couple of things, just as brief observations on what you said there. One is that I actually drank about 10 times more coffee when I was stuck at home in the lockdown, because I just mapped the whole of Southeast London trying to find any independent coffee shop, which even just had a hatch for a window that was prepared to pass me a takeaway one through the hole in the wall. The other thing that tickled me is, you know, you were talking about language and why language matters. It just struck me there, because I wrote a blog on LinkedIn during the lockdown about how frustrated I was about poor habits that people employed on video conference calls, you know, not being present, doing other work, ignoring the person speaking, et cetera, et cetera. But also just the horror of seeing your own face for days and weeks and months at a time in a way that you'd never seen your own reflection before. But it struck me when you were talking there that the word furloughed sounds an awful lot like furrowed, as in furrowed brow. And I think furrowed brow is how I would describe my kind of lockdown video conference experience. I'm just going to finish up with a point now, Catherine, but this is, you know, why does all this matter? Why are we talking about self-awareness? Why are we talking about emotional intelligence? And again, I forget where I read this, but it was in relation to something you'd either written or an interview you'd been in. But this matters because you mentioned your background in sales and how companies have always pandered and poured all their effort and all their resource into treating the customer as the most important person. Of course, that customer experience is vital. But I think you made the point that the employee experience is actually catching up with the customer experience now. And why that's important is because investors are looking at this stuff really closely now, and it matters to them. If they're going to invest in companies, what is that employee experience like? So, yes, so that, I guess what I'm saying is there is hope, isn't there? Because those enlightened organizations with very self-aware leaders, that believe in emotional intelligence and vulnerability, they're going to win this one, aren't they, eventually?
I really hope so. I really hope so.
Come on, give me hope, Catherine. I teed you up for the big finish there. I mean,
that's the promise.
Yeah.
That's the promise. Yes, yes, yes. That we can actually realize people are our most important asset, that we can really, really live and breathe that because, you know, and my career started selling advertising space on a magazine called Human Resources. 30 years ago, we were saying this stuff. But I think perhaps now at the beginning of the 21st century, we can make it happen. And I, you know, certainly think that, you know, human resources, employee experience, the job of helping humans to perform at their very, very best is an incredibly exciting place to be.
And I think that's a wonderful full circle moment at which to conclude our conversation. So I just wanted to say, Catherine de la Poer, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us on Comms from the Shed.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Comms from the Shed. Hit subscribe if you want to know when new episodes are available, or check out our Instagram page for the latest updates.